in 2 weeks. They went from selling 1 out of 20 over 6 weeks to selling 4 out of 20 in 2 weeks.
Wow.
So it was a 300% increase in their sales cycle.
That's incredible.
And when I talk about leverage, the leverage isn't, it can be, you can increase sales by training salespeople, absolutely. But you can't increase the results 300%. But if you change the structure that they work within, you can just jolt the sales upward.
Hi, this is Michael Senoff with HardToFindSeminars.com and Consulting Secrets. Here is a recording with one of our newest HMA consultants. His name is Robert Stoffer. Going back and forth, I learned that Robert is an expert marketing consultant who's been in the marketing consulting field for some time. When I saw some of the case studies that he presented to me, I had to interview him to offer his interview as ongoing training for all the new HMA consultants who come on board. Just listen to this. Robert's created $800,000 for a guy in a week and a half. He sold $40,000 an hour with a $349 letter of a product that an entire telemarketing operation couldn't sell before. This strategy went on to make $400,000 in the next 2 months. He's kicked up a sales team's sales 300% in 2 weeks by doing the opposite of what most sales trainers teach. He's helped clients grow two businesses from scratch to several million a year and more. He's added profit centers to a client that grew the company from $7 million to $25 million and more. Robert offers a lot of real in-the-world trenches about the marketing consulting business. We also talk about voice broadcasting technology and how it can be modified and used to catapult your consulting business. Hang on to your seats because this is exclusive training just for the HMA consultants, and I think you're really going to benefit from Robert's experience. You know, what I want to do as I bring people into this HMA training, I want people out there in the consulting field, and they don't have to be doing consulting just like Richard's system. I mean, you're doing $1 million in consulting, and I want the people who come through here to learn from all different aspects. Why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself? How did you first get into the whole consulting gig?
Well, I probably started off in going through high school, and I think even younger, I was doing little businesses on my own, so I already had an entrepreneurial bent. So by the time I hit college, you know, I'd already played around in 10 different businesses. I mean, from car dealing to selling livestock and onward from there. My junior year in college came one of the wildest, wildest opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend whose fiance's dad owned car dealerships. He decided to move out closer to his daughter going to college. And so in Livonia, Georgia, he decided to start a car dealership. And he said, hey, get that guy Robert and have him come, and I want him to be my marketing manager.
Okay.
We started a car dealership from scratch as two juniors in college. He came in, walked into a bank, walked out with a $500,000 credit line, and said, okay, here's how you know, take a car in. Here's how you do this. Here's how you do that. I'll see you. And he went back to Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
So he left two inexperienced
juniors,
college kids in charge of a car dealership. My buddy was ace at finance, and I kind of scrambled through doing the selling of cars and the marketing of cars and how to get to people to the lot and stuff like that. So that was kind of a...
Was it a brand-name dealership or just...
No.
These were brand-new cars?
Yeah, Chrysler.
Chrysler, okay.
Chrysler under his name, which at the time was Lash. And so for 3 months we lived in a... The town was so small, there were no apartments or anything, so we lived out of a hotel room. Running this thing. It's one of those early adventures in business. After that, I went to work for Procter & Gamble in field advertising.
What is field advertising?
Field advertising, we basically, it was 100% travel. We never knew it was coming up in, you know, 3 weeks. We'd get a manila folder in the mail. It's kind of like a Mission Impossible where it says, if you decide to take it, here's your job.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be, go in, we're going to do sampling of crisp, what would it be, Citrus Hill, in the stores, and you need to hire all the samplers. Traverse City, Michigan, go. Boom. So they'd send us in to do that. Or it may be we're pulling Duncan Hines cookies off the shelf and sticking a new formulation out. You need to go over to Kellogg or Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Go. Boom. So we'd go in and hire people to yank all the product off the shelf and do things like that. It's hard to define as a job. It's everything the sales and marketing people didn't want to do.
Yeah, how long were you with them for?
About a year. After that, I went to work and I started devising businesses. And I mainly started for myself. I started on the sales side, working with their sales forces and whatnot, because that's where the majority of my experience. But as you're selling, you start looking at products, you start looking at what they're doing, and, well, how can I get more leverage? And so that led to marketing. And so as I worked on the marketing, for example, on copyright and things like that, and then my question was, usually as a copywriter, a client comes and goes, here, I'm selling this to this market, write something. I started looking, where was the real leverage? And it was actually deciding what markets and what products were going to those markets. And so I sort of climbed the totem up to working more with strategy than specifically with sales or copywriting.
When you were doing consulting with businesses on the sales side, was that just something that you put together? Were you following like a formal program like Sandler Sales Institute or something like that?
I put together a bunch of stuff from NLP and sales training I had, personal techniques I'd done.
And how'd that go for you?
It went well.
But it was limited because it wasn't. That was just one aspect of growing a business.
Correct. It's one pillar. And in the long run, as we discover a little later on in the call here, it's not the highest leverage you can go after. It was kind of the quest for leverage. How can I make a bigger impact with clients than what I'm doing? As a quick example, with a sales force, you're dealing with behavioral change. So you can come in and get them motivated. Their performance might go up a week or two afterwards, and it drops back down because there hasn't been skill change. So, but skill change, guess what? That takes practice, it takes discipline, it takes follow-up, things like that. So you're looking at a months-long process to get maybe 25-30% increase in what they're doing. And we'll talk later, if I can alter the structure they operate in and the processes they approach the client with, we can get hundreds of percent increase in an extraordinarily short time.
Okay, so the quest for leverage then came copywriting.
Right, and essentially it's salesmanship multiplied.
Right.
So, I started looking at these. It was back in 88, 89, I ran across these guys, Gary Halbert, John Carlton, Jay Abraham.
Had you first, I love hearing this story, had you first run across any of these guys?
Actually, from my dad. He'd gotten some mailings from the early Jefferson Institute. There's a guy named, at that time, Mark Stoddard.
Mark Stoddard, yeah.
He was more the star than the other guys.
Right.
The other guys kind of came to his show. They had Gary and others doing the talking, and John Carlton, I still remember his gun to the head analogy back then, and his promise to help any copywriter for free. If they call him, and I didn't call, but I kind of laughed today because obviously he's one of the superstars in copywriting today. So I heard that stuff, and it just clicked something inside of me. I would go out and walk for hours, listening to him, writing notes, taking notes in the dictation machine, hand transcribing things, and it's hard to say why it clicked, but it's like I found home. It was more marketing oriented than just pure sales oriented.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to make a much bigger impact on a business.
Mm-hmm.
Much faster, much easier, for less money. And then it went from there.
Let's talk about some case studies. You had sent me some information that you had created $800,000 for a guy in a week and a half. What's that all about?
This is a classic example of the leverage of a sales letter versus individual salespeople. Came walking in. They were selling seminars. It was a $395 seminar. And the way they sold was they send out brochures and then follow up with telemarketing. It was a yearly event. The year before, they sent out a brochure and they made one sale. Then telemarketers, and they'd have to sell them for 5 months. Telemarketers would call for 5 months, following up and selling in person. I sat down, wrote a sales letter for them. We sent it out, and as you'll find, it's very common over the objection of their marketing vice president, because we don't talk that way, and no one will read that. And the next week and a half, 905 orders came into the. They didn't even have a system to handle it. 905 orders flooded pretty much every voicemail box in the company.
How many did they send out?
That was out of 6,000.
So they had a list of 6,000, and the way they were doing it, they were just sending a lousy, like a trifold brochure.
Beautiful brochure.
Beautiful four-color brochure?
Yes.
And multi-page or just front and back?
Multi-page.
Okay. For this seminar, what was the seminar selling?
It was a sales training kind of get-together for real estate agents.
So they were spending all this money on telemarketing, following up a...
And commissions, correct.
And commissions. And so how did you approach the guy? How did you get to write the sales letter? What did you know him, or how did it all start?
I'd done sales training for his people. Then I got to talking to his sons about, this isn't where the real leverage is. So they went and talked to their... It was a family business. They talked to their dad, and he was, well, do a one-page black-and-white flyer. And then they'd mail them first class. And I go, that's not the answer. And so we're kind of button heads. He goes, no, just do a flyer. I'm going, that's not the answer. And then their VP of marketing is going, he told you to do a flyer, you do a flyer. And so I went and wrote a sales letter.
Mm-hmm.
And I just knew in my heart this is the wrong approach to take.
How many pages?
This was a four-pager.
Okay.
And so I came up, and the VP of marketing freaks. He goes, you're told not to do this. No one's going to read this stuff. And I'm going, let's just show it to the man, the guy in charge. He's going, okay, but I'm telling him I had nothing to do with this. I'm going, fine, let's just talk to him. So we go in and talk to him, and the guy reads it and kind of looks over his glasses, and instantly the VP is going, I told him not to do this, on and on and on. And he goes, let's do it. Let's try it.
First class, 6,000 people?
Yep.
Hand addressed or typed?
Typed.
Live stamp or indicia?
Indicia.
Return card?
Nope.
Nothing. Just address?
Not even address.
Nothing at all?
You got till Friday to call was the only the pool.
You got Friday to call on the return envelope, on the envelope?
No, there's nothing on the envelope.
What?
I made them take off the company name on the envelope. White typed address.
Do you remember the headline?
Something I never do today, you know, as you get more conservative, but it was something to the effect of his whole thing was the superstar real estate agent.
Yeah.
And those customers knew it, and it had a buzz about him. And so what I drilled into was the excitement of the conference. And people would actually get up at 4 in the morning and go stand in line to get the best seats. It was through interviewing the sales force, and they'd tell me stories about people jumping over seats to get, you know, just a zoo. I tapped into that nerve with a headline. It was something to the effect of superstars bribe security officers. And from there it went into security officers say that, you know, these superstars are more rabid than Madonna fans. But then it went into the typical benefit sell and everything would be. So, ironically, it's something I wouldn't do today, but it hit the nerve.
Okay, why wouldn't you do it today? What would you do different now that you...
Well, typically today I lead with more of a benefit-oriented approach on something specific they're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
And where this one was more story copy without a promise. It worked, but it's a much riskier approach to copy.
6,000 went out, and what happened?
Some got it within the region the next day. Mm-hmm. Phones started ringing off the hook at night. All the messages were going into the various secretaries' voicemail boxes.
Mm-hmm.
So they come up the next morning. You know, there's 100-something people signed up for this thing. And then it just started to grow from there as the mail hit more and more of the places. And so within a week and a half, it was 905 orders. Salespeople were just incredibly upset because I just cut all the commissions out. The secretaries were upset because they were spending all their time now transferring orders. The VP was upset because he looked bad. The only guy smiling was the owner.
What did he say to you? Do you remember?
He never said anything to me. No. He told someone else, like, you know, I found a winner here of, you know, a consultant or whatever. But that was about it.
What was in it for you? Did you negotiate something?
I had a monthly retainer deal, and that was part of it.
Okay.
There wasn't any percentage or any such thing.
Okay, great. That's a great story, the power of one sales letter. Okay, you sold $40,000 in an hour with a $349 letter of a product that an entire telemarketing operation couldn't sell before.
Right. This is a fun one. I took out a client. He was not the real estate, the mortgage industry. Pretty well-respected fella as far as education. And we got the wild idea, and this was back in 84 or 5 when teleconferences really weren't a big thing back then. They actually had value, and it cost 60 cents a minute to put one on and per person and such. So we came up with this idea, okay, we'll create this great teleconference where once a month people get on with leaders in the industry from all over the industry. We'll have them pay $2,200 for that privilege.
And this is a mortgage?
Two mortgage originators. And so we'll charge them $2,200 from that. The guy had a good name, so it was a good chance. It had worked on the real estate side, so it was kind of common sense that it should work. For a month and a half, his sales team, and this is to existing customers, we call their best customers, go, you know, we got this great new thing, it's going to be this, you got to be on it. No sales. People would not buy that.
For $2,200.
Right. You know, in hindsight, you go, oh, that's crazy. You're asking them $2,200 for 1 hour a month. That's just a bad proposition. So I'm thinking about it. The owner of this company was an incredibly persuasive speaker. So I'm thinking, and I had the thought, you know, why not use the teleconference to sell the teleconference? So what I did is a real small, I don't know what you call it, an A4, invitation size envelope with parchment paper. I sent off an invitation. It was pretty much announcing one of my best customers. I wanted to let you know first. We're going to be launching a new product. Didn't tell them what it was. We're launching a new service. It has to do with these basic areas. The call's limited to X number of people. We tested about a buck a piece. I remember it was 349 people we sent. It was probably $349 investment. Sent that out.
How many did you send out?
349.
Just 349 letters?
Right.
Okay.
It was a 38% of the people came on. So what does that come out to, 70, 80, 90 people? A little over 100 people on the call. We do the call. Pretty much I did an info commercial with the guy. I sat and we talked back and forth, and I went and I wrote this script for him and then roughly outlined it. You know, he didn't need a word for word.
Mm-hmm.
So we outlined the flow, kind of a problem-solution motivational sequence approach, and what it was and how it would, and how this this conference would let him get information before anyone else did, how he was on the road, you know, several times a month all over the country learning new ideas, but he didn't get to share them until his big seminars, like once every 6 months. So this is a way they could get the ideas to their competitors. So that was the content of the half-hour teleconference. As soon as that teleconference ended, the phones just flooded. And the next half hour, they created 22 sales.
Did you ask on the teleconference for the order, or you just information loaded?
Information loaded, and then call if you want to join. That was was not a hard sell.
Wow.
Other than hard, it was informational in the sense of, you know, it was benefit-laden, feel-laden, from the standpoint of what they get and the advantages of being on it. But it wasn't a hard sell and do this now and you'll get such. They went on to roll that out because he had a much, much larger list. And over the next month, I brought in hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Okay, now let me ask you this. What was in it for you? Did you set up a...
had a retainer relationship.
Just a retainer?
Yeah.
At that time, did you think about doing contingencies?
Yes, I'd had some early bad experiences with them.
Can we talk about that real quick?
Sure.
What were some of the bad experiences with contingency?
Well, first, I'd observed firsthand, I can't mention names.
Okay.
One very well-known marketeer doing a joint venture with another very well-known company. I happened to be behind the scenes with the other company. I set the deal up. The marketing, the guy pulled the trigger on, did incredible for the company.
Mm-hmm.
So the amount that they were going to own based on their agreement was huge.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably $200,000 they had to write a check for. And I noticed things kind of going on in the accounting department and scrambling and closed-door meetings and everything else. And basically what they did is they cooked the books on him. And I kind of watched how that went. And there's nothing, they had contracts, everything in place, but there's nothing you can do to protect yourself against someone that's going to do that. So I'd seen that. I did some joint ventures. I put two companies together. One company that I had a good relationship with, the other one I called cold, got them to come together. I even thought of the concept of the product that they'd sell. It was actually one of the first direct marketing packages ever sold to the real estate industry. So we put this venture together, got all the players together, and then one of the partners in the business comes to me and goes, well, I got a problem. The other two partners don't want to pay you. Because, and I still remember this quote, all you did was introduce them to somebody. Okay, never mind that we're now, 15 years later?
Mm-hmm.
That product has been making millions a year for them. Mm-hmm. So it just came down to the defending yourself. If you're going to play with bad people, it's very difficult. So with those two experiences, I had moved to retainer rather rapidly. And I had done other ventures, and getting people to execute can be a challenge as well. So for me, it's like, well, you got to make money here.
That's kind of what's nice about Richard's his system, because he experienced similar situations, and he went right to retainer or per project basis. And then it gives you a chance to kind of build a relationship as you work with someone. And then if you want to go contingency and you've got the trust and you feel good about it, then there's some opportunities down the road.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's very important. Because I know there's a lot of hype around joint ventures, and all you just do this one thing and millions will come flooding in and you don't have to work again. And the truth is, yeah, that can happen. But there's an also truth that when people start making tons of money and they have to write you a really big check and they look and go, what did you do? You made a phone call. So then human nature kind of comes in. And so unless there's a really strong relationship there, the overwhelming pressure on the person is to somehow slight the deal and disengage it. And that doesn't at all mean they don't work. And I still put them together for my clients. They're an extraordinarily fast way to grow a business.
There's another aspect that I've experienced being on the side of not being paid a commission on a joint venture, and that is you feel like you're almost an employee, you know, because that person controls the money, and because you've set the deal up, you're almost like you're just – it's just a bad feeling. You feel like because they're holding your check that they have the ultimate power. It's just
you're
not
– in the bag. You're having the bag.
Yeah, it's not a good feeling at all.
No, it's not fun. One thing I started doing, and I did it on a few deals, and I finally said, screw it, I'll just go with retainer relationships. But it was an effective sales tool, and it would be something to be effective. Like normally, I'd charge $15,000 or $20,000 for this project, but I believe so much in the impact it's going to have, I'll discount my fee $10,000 and only take a $5,000 upfront chunk against some percentage of the profits that will work out. Well, I would have been happy to have done it for the $5,000, but it postured it far better. you know, in some cases, it did create some residual income doing it that way. But I was at least covered.
No, that's a good way to position it. Here's another one. I've helped a client grow two businesses from scratch to several million a year and more.
Mm-hmm.
What are we referring to that?
I've got a client has two businesses, and one in the voice marketing industry. And
What industry was it?
Voice marketing.
Voice marketing.
It's the automated systems where you can load up a million customers and have each one get a message on their answer machine.
Voice broadcasting.
Mm-hmm. And the other one was a software product in the mortgage industry called the Mortgage Coach.
Mm-hmm.
Both were from scratch. And so you got all the fun and joy of fighting your way through the jungle on what approaches will work, what won't work, what appeals will work, and so on. One of the fascinating ones on the voice marketing side was...
This is the end of part one, exclusive training for HMA consultants. Please continue to part two. Here's a tip. If you're listening to these audio recordings in MP3, here's a way where you can listen through the content twice as fast and still be able to absorb all the information. What you want to do is you want to go to a website and download a free trial of goldwave.com, GOLDWAVE.com. Now, this is an audio file editor, and one of the features on this editor is it allows you to play the audio recordings at any speed you want. So you can have it speed up to where it sounds like you're listening to the chipmunks where their voices are real high. But I do a lot of editing of audio recordings, and I find when I'm doing the editing, you're still able to listen to audio content about twice the speed of normal language. And it takes a little bit of practice, but you can fly through audio content. So if you like to learn by audio and you want to listen to content and you don't mind listening to the different higher pitch voice, it's a very effective way of getting through content twice as fast.